Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Julian Morris. I'm Vice President of Research at Reason Foundation, and I'm very honoured to host today a call with the Honourable Boyden Gray, who is, in addition to being a Reason trustee, a foremost lawyer and expert in environmental law, as well as having been the ambassador of the United States to Europe. Welcome, Boyden.
Oh, nice to be here.
Thanks. I thought I'd start it off with just a quick overview of what, first of all, the sort of game plan, and then an outline of the main issue that we'll be discussing, which is the Clean Power Plan. I think after I'll just give a couple of minutes outline of the Clean Power Plan, and then I'll ask some questions to Ambassador Gray, and then we'll after about 20 minutes of that we'll move to Q&A with the participants. So to begin then, in June 2014 the Environmental Protection Agency issued, I'll give it its long title, the Carbon Pollution Emission Guidelines for Existing Stationary Sources Electric Generating Units. This has been dubbed the Clean Power Plan. And basically what it does is it requires states to introduce various measures, the objective of which is to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide in each state to 30% below 2005 levels by 2030, specifically targeting emissions from existing power plants. And to achieve that, the EPA would require states to set goals for reducing emissions using four building blocks. So it actually specifies in particular ways in which it believes states should reduce emissions. And it claims that these are consistent with the best system of emission reduction, which is a requirement of the part of the Clean Air Act, Section 111D, under which the Clean Power Plan has been promulgated. These four building blocks are, first of all, to reduce the carbon intensity of generation at individual affected power plants through improvements in the heat rate. Secondly, reduce emissions from the most carbon intensive power plants in amounts that results from substituting generation of those power plants with generation from less carbon intensive units. So that's basically switching from, simplistically saying, switching from the use of coal to natural gas and other lower carbon emitting sources. Thirdly, reduce emissions from power plants by substituting generation with low or zero carbon generation. So that's in the mind of the EPA, things like wind power and solar generation. And fourthly, reduce emissions from power plants through demand side energy efficiency, so mandating energy efficiency improvements. Now, in a conversation before we got on, Ambassador Gray mentioned some concerns that he had regarding the legality of several of these building blocks. So, Boyden, do you want to outline some of the concerns that you have or that you believe some of the legal concerns regarding the attempt by the EPA to impose these requirements on states?
Well, I think the starting point is to remind people of the rather startling observation made by the EPA administrator that she made not too long ago, a year ago. This is not about pollution control. It's about increased efficiency at our plants. It's about investments in renewables and clean energy. It's not about pollution control. That's not a good start, I think, for the agency to admit. And I think one of the reasons she says that is probably because in the back of her head she knows that most of the provisions, if not all, are really can't work and really aren't legally permissible. There's no authorization for reduced demand control. I mean, for using demand control to reduce use of energy. There really is no authority for EPA to go outside what they call the ring fence, which is beyond regulating each individual utility by itself. One can get into the weeds on this. There's also a fundamental problem with the statute, which says that EPA cannot regulate sources under the section they're regulating if these regulate pollution from sources under this regulation if these same sources are regulated under another provision of the Clean Air Act, which these sources are. That is, utility sources are regulated under the air toxics provision of the Act, and by the terms of the statute, they cannot be regulated over, duplicatively regulated by EPA under another provision. That's designed in part to prohibit double counting and double and multiple and overlapping regulation. So,
right.
That's sort of the straight legal background, and there's a lot more that perhaps is more important about the policy of reducing pollution in this fashion in terms of a thing like global warming for which the Clean Air Act was not designed, but I'll let you get into that as you wish.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, in relation to the legality of using Section 111D for regulating carbon emissions, part of the justification for the Clean Power Plan, a significant part of it, up to possibly 90% of the justification in the regulatory impact assessment of the plan, comes from reducing the adverse health effects from other incidental emissions that would be reduced according to the EPA as a result of implementing the plan. So, in particular, the emission of particulate matter and ozone precursors. I guess that cuts to your point that if there is another part of the Clean Air Act that is that exists and is being used to regulate those sources, which is the case, right? Then why is it that the EPA is attempting to regulate those emissions also under 111D? I mean, is that correct?
That's correct. That statute, Section 111. Quite clearly and unambiguously prohibits EPA from regulating fine particle pollution or any other criteria pollutant that has been established, for which a standard has been established under separate sections of the Act and for which there are a whole set of regulations designed to deal with those pollutants. And that's why, because there is a comprehensive statutory regime for those pollutants, this section is not available. And if it's not available to regulate, I think the courts are going to say, well, you can't claim as a justification for this regulation the benefits from reducing a pollutant that you're prohibited from regulating. So that is, I think, a very high hurdle EPA is going to have to get around. And I should add quickly that the monetary values EPA assigns to these sort of so-called co-benefits from these other pollutants is vastly overstated in any event. So they're doubly or triply sort of out of the box on that ground alone. And it's a trick EPA's tried before. The Chief Justice has noted it in a case that was just argued a month ago. What are you doing, counting all these co-benefits to justify a rule of a different pollutant? And I think the courts are going to come down very hard on this issue. The fact of the matter is there just isn't much CO2 benefit, and that's probably why, to go back to what I said in the beginning, Gina McCarthy says this is not about pollution control. It really doesn't do much for climate change, if practically anything. The benefits that can count for the United States by doing this rule are dwarfed by the cost of the rule. And since it's a cost-benefit provision of the Clean Air Act, I think that is going to make survival of this regulation very, very doubtful.
Right. So just to explain also another point, which is that the 10% of those benefits that allegedly come from carbon dioxide reductions actually are also overstated because they are global benefits, whereas a plain reading of what should be included would limit us to the impact on the United States. Is that right? Which would be about 10% or less. Yeah, yeah.
That is correct.
So then we're down to about 1% of the total benefits that are alleged from this actually being related to carbon dioxide emissions. And meanwhile, you get all the costs. So you've maybe got, $1 billion of benefits at the absolute outside of versus even on the EPA's estimate, $7 to $8 billion a year in costs. So then it fails the cost benefit test. So you think that the courts are going to rule this illegal?
I just don't see how they can approve this kind of imbalance between the costs and the benefits. It's really a ratio that is just, I think, completely unsustainable.
But at what point will the courts be able to rule on this? Because states are being asked to submit their SIPs, their state implementation plans now. Will court cases be resolved soon enough before states are forced to submit these implementation plans?
Well, that's a very good question, and because of that problem, a couple of major companies, coal companies, Peabody and Murray Energy, have brought a lawsuit challenging the rule even before it's finished. I think it's probably less than 50-50 that the court will grant, will reverse the rule, will throw the rule out before it's done. But they could very well issue a stay. I mean, that is, issue an injunction saying, EPA, you cannot require the states to do anything until we have approved the rule, if in fact we do approve it. And I think that is a very likely outcome of upcoming proceedings, so that the danger of the states completing everything even before the rule is finished will evaporate. Or will be greatly reduced. EPA has been extremely aggressive here, more aggressive than any rule I've ever seen, in pushing the states, blackmailing, sort of intimidating the states into going along with the rule long before the rule has been made final, long before they've finished making all the decisions. And they've done that to basically make the case a moot before it's even begun. And I think the courts fully understand that, in an argument that was made in the Court of Appeals, the second most important court for regulation here in Washington. The judges all understood the dilemma that the states are in and the companies are in, and I think are going to take steps to make sure that they have ample chance to have this case reviewed in court without having to spend extraordinary sums of money to comply before it's done.
And of course, when you talk about blackmail and what the EPA is doing, as I understand, is threatening to impose its own mandate on power plants in states that don't submit their own implementation plan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So states are in a bind, and some have said that they're going to comply, and they're already doing so. So what happens to states that submit these implementation plans? Are they then bound by them, regardless of whether the rule is finalized?
No, they're not bound by them. But if the utilities have already made the adjustments by adding certain equipment, which is already there, the chances are better than 50-50 that they'll run the equipment. But obviously running equipment that you don't need to run or shouldn't have to run is an expense on top of the capital costs of constructing it. And so I think that it'll just be what's known by economists as stranded cost. It is wasted money, which is something we can't afford to do in this country at this moment, and it's a really bad faith ploy by the government to get people to do something that the government is not authorized to force.
Well, if ultimately the clean power ban is abandoned, it's ruled, if the courts rule it illegal and no such thing emerges, or whatever emerges is quite different in nature. If some states have implemented put into process their plans and the electricity generators have begun to procure or actually gone through and procured new equipment and started to adapt to the plan, would they have any legal recourse against either the states or the EPA on this?
That's doubtful, but it's not totally clear. Professor Tribe of Harvard, who's a liberal constitutional law professor, a Democrat, if you will, has said that he thinks that this case involves what's known as a takings under the Constitution. That is, where the government's not has grabbed your property without compensating you for it, and that's a point that's well taken, well made, but never has been fully litigated. So we don't really know. It's never been decided, but it's a good argument. So one, we just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been really insightful and interesting, and we've now had about 20 minutes of discussion between you and me. Perhaps we should open it up to others, and if there are questions from the floor, I believe I should be getting things through. Here we go. I've got a couple of hellos from people. No questions yet. In the lead up to this call, in the advertisement for it, if you like, we also mentioned the paper that I've been working on, which is going to be released in the next few weeks on the social cost of carbon, make a few comments about that, which I think sort of really just reinforces the concerns that we've already discussed about the Clean Power Plan. I mean, in that paper, I did a fairly comprehensive look back at the way in which the social cost of carbon was developed by the interagency working group of the U.S. government, led by the EPA, and the numbers on it, don't really add up. There's clearly a significant bias towards sort of overestimating the impact of carbon in order to justify not only the Clean Power Plan but a whole range of regulations that have been put in place in the course of the past seven or so years. If it turns out, Boyden, that the social cost of carbon that's been developed by the interagency working group is a significant overestimation. Would that provide a means to challenge? I think more importantly, other regulations that have been predicated on that social cost.
It could be. It's hard to. I'm trying to sort of scan my own brain for what rules have been issued based on the social cost of carbon that could not have met a cost benefit test without using those numbers, and I really frankly can't think of any that have been squarely dependent on these numbers. What's clear is that EPA is going to continue to use the numbers and to grow the numbers and it's going to begin to seep into the regulatory process, and it's going to affect other agencies and what they do about rules they issue that may have some indirect or maybe even small direct impact on the environment. And that's the real danger, is that this thing spreads across government without ever being vetted or peer-reviewed by any independent scientific body, or actually finalized in any authorized process by the U.S. government. And then it becomes a reality that everybody has to live with, and it's never been justified.
Yeah. So we have a question from one of the participants. Will the court decision regarding the legality of the Clean Power Plan depend on the liberal-conservative makeup of the specific court, or in your opinion, is this a fairly straightforward matter that doesn't depend at all on the if you like partisan biases of the judges in question?
Well, that's a very good question. Historically, well, going back to the 70s, the court was quite partisan, and decisions did seem to be related to which party appointed the judges. But beginning with the Democratic judge, who still is around and still is retired, but still does a little work for the court on a few cases, Harry Edwards, he was the chief judge. And he really cracked down on what he thought was partisanship on the court. And ever since, for the last two decades or more, the court has been very nonpartisan in its approach. And it remains to be seen whether the three new judges, which were part of a sort of a court-packing effort, they were put on the court when the court didn't really need more judges. They have the lowest caseload, had the lowest before the new judges were appointed, the lowest caseload of any appellate court in the country, and so there really wasn't enough work to go around as it was. It remains to be seen what those three judges do, but over time, my view is the court will develop the way it did, for the last two decades. That is, they will all melt in, and there will be very little partisanship in how this court rules.
There has been a tendency on the part of the courts in general to provide deference to agencies. I mean, starting with the Chevron case. I think it would be useful actually for the participants if you could explain what that is and whether you think that this could be kind of part of a process towards kind of reversing that agency deference.
That's the deference question is a very tricky one, because it's a judge-made doctrine, and it's honored in the breach as much as in the observance, and courts do with it what they want to do, and they will twist it around to suit their purposes, use it when it's helpful, kind of ignore it when it's not, in terms of how they want to decide the case on the merits. For background, you mentioned the Chevron case. There really has been a doctrine of courts deferring to reasonable decisions made by agencies for decades on the grounds that the court's not elected. They didn't make the law up. The law was developed by Congress and delegated to the agencies to implement. What's happened in the last 10 years or less is the Congress has become less and less specific, more and more sort of irresponsible in just delegating huge grants of authority without any kind of guidance to the agencies, and the courts are having more and more trouble trying to figure out whether the agency's interpretation of what Congress basically didn't do is the correct interpretation. So the courts are getting tougher about this and are themselves engaging in a practice, I hope that this doesn't bore the listeners, but engaging in a practice known as constitutional avoidance. That is, they will take it into their own hands to construe a statute very narrowly to avoid the vagueness problem that confronts them when they're trying to figure out how much should they defer. So they're beginning to defer less and less to agency interpretations of statutes, and more and more asserting their own interpretive capacity, because they think the Congress is being more and more irresponsible, and the agencies are taking more and more advantage of the open-ended nature of what Congress has done. So the courts, I think, are in the process of correcting this difficulty on their own, and I think they're on to it. They understand it, and I think they have to fix it. I don't know how Congress does it, since it's partly Congress's fault to begin with that they have put the courts in this position. So, but I think the courts will work it out, and I don't think there's a legislative solution that really works.
I was going to ask, actually, because there's moves afoot to attempt to override, you know, the Clean Power Plan in Congress.
Well, there is. Maybe I'm interrupting you. There is. There are at least two ways for Congress to stop this. I mean, this particular rule or any other particular rule is the Nichols Act, the Congressional Review Act, which allows them the right to throw the rule out. It's only been used once before, an ergonomic rule issued by OSHA, the Occupational Safety Agency. But that's available to use and has worked. Or they can, of course, it would probably be vetoed by this president, but not by a Republican president. They can and have in the past adopted appropriations riders. It used to be a more common practice 10, 20 years ago than it is today, since we don't seem to have budgets that get to get developed. We have continuing resolutions, and they vote on the whole batch of spending. But you can, and the agencies, the Congress does, put on provisions on appropriations bills that direct the agencies that they cannot spend money implementing X, Y, or Z regulation. So there are at least two ways that Congress can nullify this rule, which would be much quicker and would go into effect immediately, rather than trying to fiddle with the doctrine of preemption, which might take years to work its way through the courts.
Right. Well, that's I guess somewhat optimistic. Although, as you say, an attempt to put this through as an appropriation rider would most likely be vetoed by the administration, since it seems that the plan itself, the Clean Power Plan, exists because of a desire on the part of the administration to pursue a particular set of kind of economic goals. I mean,
right. That is true. But if the administration were to veto a rider, veto a bill just because of a single provision, that would result in a partial or complete shutdown of the government. where
right.
in circumstances where it would be clear who did it. The last time around, when the Republicans were fighting over overall spending and said they wouldn't pass this, wouldn't pass that, and so there was no budget at all and no money at all, the government did have to shut down, and that was blamed on the Republicans since they had the power to, and maybe the duty, the liberals argued, to adopt a budget to pass, to permit a budget to be enacted. This would be different. This would be the president singling out a single provision in a huge piece of legislation and saying, that's so important that I'm going to shut the government down to get it. And, you know, politically, that could be a real problem because, as we've discussed, the actual benefits from this rule to the U.S. To the U.S. people, to the U.S. To this country, the actual benefits are negative. That is, it.
Right.
You know, how do you shut down the government in order to go into further debt? That's not a happy circumstance to put yourself into. So, I think the president might have to think twice about vetoing a rider. Now, of course, it might be difficult to get the rider, because it is subject to a filibuster, or could be subject to a filibuster, and the Democrats might block it in the Senate. There are probably lots of senators who come from states that are especially impacted by this rule who don't like it, Democratic senators. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see more than 60 votes available for such a provision.
Okay. Well, I'm actually feeling a lot better about this. The prospects for stopping this seemingly pretty harmful.
Well, rule. let me just lest you feel too good, Julian, let me point out that there's a rule right behind it, called the ozone rule, where the kinds of vulnerabilities that we've been discussing on this phone call don't exist. This is a ozone is a criteria pollutant. It's been procedurally properly done. There is a question about whether the costs equal the benefits, but for criteria pollutants, as those of us in this business have to constantly remind ourselves, the court has said that in that circumstance, you don't look at costs and benefits. So the fact that ozone may cost a great deal more than it benefits is not an issue that the courts can deal with in the first instance. So that's why I say the ozone rule may be far more dangerous in the long run than this particular rule that we've been discussing, precisely because the courts are unable or prohibited from weighing the costs and the benefits of what EPA has proposed. And so I think the ozone rule is potentially very dangerous. It depends on how the government sets it, but they could issue a rule that would put Yosemite National Park into non-attainment. I mean, how would you possibly improve the air quality of Yosemite National Park when there aren't any cars there to begin with, or plants, or anything else?
And this, of course, is because some ozone is produced through natural processes. Some transports over hundreds
some
of miles domestically, and some transports over thousands of miles from Asia.
So over to China, yes. But in my home state of North Carolina, where I grew up, there are the Great Smokies, they're called, and the beautiful Blue Ridge. These are interrelated mountain ranges. And the Blue Ridge is called the Blue Ridge because it looks blue, and it looks blue because there's a lot of pine trees that are throwing off volatile organic compounds that create smog when the sun's out. And the Smokies are called the Great Smokies because of the same problem. And so, you're not going to go in and chop down every tree in the Smoky Grand National Park. You're just not going to do that. Or the Blue Ridge Mountains, they're one of the most beautiful spots in the country. So that's why I say the ozone rule is potentially, what are you going to do? You're going to, if you can't, you're not going to chop down trees, and so what are you going to do? Well, you may have to close every pizza parlor.
So part of this is under the criteria pollutant, as a criteria pollutant, the additional emissions must be offset by reducing existing emissions.
Exactly.
Because you've got to have an ambient level that complies.
You can't build a new plant unless you, you know, tear down another plant. And so, how do you do that that's fair?
Right. So I mean, this creates empowers municipal and state authorities to make arbitrary decisions about what economic activities can take place. It is pretty disturbing.
It's very disturbing. Very disturbing.
I mean, so given the threat posed by the ozone rule, and it looks like they're going to clamp down down to 65 parts per billion or thereabouts. Does that, which is significantly below the current level, and would put Yellowstone borderline in non-attainment. Is there a way that Congress could act to address this? I mean, could it use the Nichols Act?
It could use the Nichols Act, and it could use a rider. Again, two things that would work while Obama's president, but could conceivably work if we had a Republican president, who of course could reverse the standard. You know, through rulemaking, it would take a couple of years to do it, but a new president could do that, and probably win in court, since the thing is so close to the line. Anyway, the way it's now proposed, but you know, our air quality is the best in the world. There is no country which has the benefits of clean cities the way the United States does. I mean, maybe Tokyo is a rival. Virtually every cab and public vehicle runs on natural gas, which is non-polluting. So Tokyo is a relatively clean city compared to most of the world, and as clean as any city we have. But we have incredibly good air quality, and it's very hard to make it much better. We're in very good shape here, and we should be very proud of what we've been able to do in the last 30 years without really curbing economic growth. But there's not much left to do, and it's always the last pound or the last ton that costs all the big money.
So, is there a sort of fundamental problem then with having a standing agency such as the EPA, whose remit is essentially to continue to ratchet down on emissions to air, emissions to water, and so on. Once you've achieved, you know, what can realistically be achieved in terms of improving the environment in objective terms? One can't really go into subjective elements of the environment, which aesthetic and so on. But I mean, to the extent that one has achieved the measures that benefit society objectively, what's to be done? Do we at least change the remit of the EPA so that it no longer is required to continuously review and ratchet down emissions, and how to achieve that?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question, because you would think the EPA would be happy to declare victory. But if it declared victory in any one of these air quality issues or water quality, which is also the best in the world, if they were to, I mean, the reputation is that Europe is much cleaner than we are, but that's just wrong. I mean, the pollution in their cities is much worse than ours, much worse. But we continue to live under the myth of the mainstream media describing how we're all about to choke to death, and it's just simply not true. You know, the incidence of asthma has gone up in direct proportion to the amount of pollution that's gone down. But instead, the increase in asthma is blamed on the reduction in pollution. I mean, you know, maybe we ought to start repolluting and to get the asthma down. I don't know. But they're really, you know, the major problems have been solved, and victory should be declared. There's got to be maintenance to make sure we don't backslide and make things worse again. But you wouldn't need an agency the size of EPA. I don't know how many employees they have, but they have to to stay in business. They have to constantly make these rules stricter and stricter and stricter when there's really nothing left to regulate.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fascinating discussion, Boyden. I am slightly put at ease with regard to the Clean Power Plan and hopeful that something will be done to rectify the harm of that. But I'm now much more worried about the ozone rule and more generally about the EPA. But I should thank you very much for your very learned contribution today.
Well, my pleasure.
And that's an end. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.